This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Con Fringe reading series.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome again to Bristol Con Fringe. We have a packed evening for you tonight, but first of all I have one or two announcements that I need to make. First of all, just in case any of you don't have copies of this absolutely stupendously, wonderfully amazing anthology, there are copies for sale. Joe will be happy to relieve you of your money.
Always.
We are also, of course, still selling tickets for the amazingly fabulous Airship Ball. And again, I think Ross or Joe will be happy to relieve you.
Joe's got the receipt, so you can make your money.
Give your money to Ross and Joe will give you a receipt and they will fight it out amongst themselves. The other thing I need to remind you about is that on Wednesday night in Foyles, we have an American visitor, Karen Joy Fowler, who is an amazing, fabulous writer. She's got, I think, 2 Nebulas, 3 World Fantasy Awards, and 1 Shirley Jackson Award. She's also the co-founder of the Tiptree Award, which is one of the most interesting awards in the science fiction field. And her latest novel, in addition to being a Nebula nominee, is also on the shortlist for something called the Penn Faulkner Award, which is basically America's answer to the Booker. So, straddling the science fiction and mainstream divide very effectively there. Your mainstream reading friends will probably remember her for a book called The Jane Austen Book Club, which was a Richard and Judy pick about 4 or 5 years ago. And of course, heaps and heaps of fabulous science fiction stuff as well. So it will be well worth attending. I've got a review of the new novel up on my blog today, if anybody is interested. Although it has this massive reveal in it, so actually I'm encouraging people not to read reviews at all and just go out and buy it. So, yeah, you get the full effect. So that'll be at Foyles. I think it's about £4 a ticket, but definitely well worth going to. That's on Wednesday night. Look forward to seeing some of you there. Right, so we have 3 authors for you tonight. We have finally managed to track down our international man of mystery, Scott Lewis. We have half of the amazing editorial team from Comicology and Airship Shape and Bristol Fashion, Ms. Ross Clark. And entertaining us first, because she has a train to catch, is Rosie Oliver, who is pretty much the definition of a Renaissance woman. She has a degree in engineering from Oxford and another degree in creative writing from Bath. So completely straddling the spectrum there of academic achievement. And she is also the proud slave of a robot cat, which she may get to tell you about at some point. Please welcome Rosie Oliver.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Can you all hear me? Okay, I'm going to read a short story which was set in Bristol. It's published on Cracks and eBooks as of last month, and it's called Getting There. Sitting around the fire station, waiting for the off, is nothing unusual. We all find something to beat off the boredom. Some play cards, others watch videos, whatever it takes. In Seb's case, it was designing a holograph of a 3-dimensional chessboard to see all 512 squares at once. And I mean all. Not easy with 8 ordinary chessboards stacked one on top of the other. Every square got his attention. He changed their colours, varied their translucencies, even altered the thicknesses of their outlines. No matter what he did, the result did not pass his acid test of seeing all the squares along any diagonal. His comm stick went everywhere with him. I'd once seen him unfurl it in a pub table, build the holograph, chessboard, and patiently adjust the shade of one square for over an hour. Of course, it was with him at the St. Philip's fire. Although we were the last out of the station, Seb raced us through the back rows to arrive first at the centre of a shabby tower blocks connected randomly by bridges and tunnels. Smoke rose from a subway entrance, the third floor of one tower and a shop from the bottom of another. Screaming people streamed out of every exit in sight, including the doorways of untouched buildings. A chill of fear went down my spine as the others looked grimly on. The seat of the fire was in the worst possible position, underground. I immediately called in more backup fire teams. Seb parked our fire engine by the Squares Lake, upwind of the subway smoke and away from any falling debris the towers might hurl at us. The vehicle's dashboard screen flicked to the line of tabs alongside an aerial map of the neighbourhood. Three red dots marked the small smoke outlets. Computer, where's the fire source? I asked, while the team bailed out to set up the pumps and hose pipes from the lake as the hydrants were dangerously close to the towers. Unable to give an answer, the computer replied. Seb, halfway out of the cab, glanced back and stopped. That map's no good. Why? Doesn't show the routes between the floors. I nodded. Over the years, people had blocked approaches from hated neighbours. Others opened routes to shorten their walk to the family. Whole floors had been denied immediate access by neighbouring floors. Towers were cut off from within towers. Tunnels looped around others without a link. Ghettoism had run rife. Best I've got. No, it's not. He climbed back in, unfurled his comm stick on the seats between us and stiffened it into a flat sheet. A few tap hits later, a semi-transparent St. Philip's sector had grown upwards out from the sheet. Amidst the confusion of colours and lines, three red blobs shone out, indicating the smoke outlets. I could just make out that they had grown tassels of amber threads. Some merged, others split. Lower down, a few converged into purple lines. The purple's where the fire could have started, Seb said. There were five of the blasted things. He queried the computer. One was a water supply main, two were sewage pipes, and the fourth was a natural aquifer. That left the fifth, a disused metro tunnel. He wiped all the threads that could not lead there and narrowed his eyes. Mostly air vents. In fact, all except that one from the subway. The thick thread he pointed to squirmed like a constipated worm. The towers were being undermined, and if nothing was done, they would come tumbling down. 9/11 all over again. We had to go down that subway, against the smoke, in narrow confined spaces, with the danger of flashovers from years of dilapidation. Despite it being a hot summer's day, I developed a cold sweat. I got out and ordered the crew in. They all knew the danger, but to a man quietly got on with the job. Nobody complained. Nobody shied away from that subway entrance. Seb ran round the front of the cab, waving his 3D map towards me. He jabbed at the top of the end of the purple thread and surrounded by a mishmash of lines and blobs. Break through the wall here, he said, some way down from the subway entrance. Go down this route, his finger traced a green straightish tube that's dropped onto another amber path, and break through all that wall here. It'll take less time. A flash tumble of risks raced through my mind. Like what if there was a cave-in when we burst through either of the walls, or we routed the air drafts to fan the flames? It would break all standard procedures. Other teams might refuse to follow the plan, and we might miss the chance of rescuing people trapped in the bypass part of the route. The decision was mine, and mine alone. I made it in that split second of urgency. A decision that led to Seb and me sitting in the brigade captain's office the following Monday morning. I felt sick. We were in for a hell of a roasting. 10 people died of smoke inhalation. 10 Bristolians who could have saved, the captain yelled. Whose crazy idea was it to knock down those walls? Mine, Seb replied before I could stop him. I take full responsibility, I said. Damn right you will. The inquest and press will crucify you, you damn fools. Our brigade's exec strode in, file in hand. Please don't get up. These are two who chose the direct route. Yes, the captain growled. My hearty congratulations on an excellent job, the exec said, shaking Seb's and then my hands. I took his hand limply, too stunned to do anything else. What? The captain asked. It's all in the report. The exec brought the file onto the desk. If they'd followed the normal procedure, the fire would have spread further and more lives would have been lost. It slowly dawned on me. I had made the right choice. I still don't know how Seb saw that route in all that translucence. Probably due to all that practice with the chessboard. And yes, he did finally get his holograph design right. Now it's used to train 3D map specialists to direct firefighters away from danger and save many lives. Okay, what I've got next is an excerpt from my infamous novel which I wrote at Bath Spa University. It follows a little bit from the theme of the short story. The actual novel is set on Miranda, and it's the fifth largest moon of the planet Uranus. It's got high chevron-shaped plateaus and deep valleys, and that was what was inspired the novel in the first place. The story so far is in a harsh mining community where truth is so valued that a priesthood developed using science as a basis exists. Alva is shunned. Why? Because she can see things behind walls and closed doors, which makes her look as if she's lying. So she suppresses her talent. When her husband dies in the latest of a series of mining accidents, she sets about investigating why they are happening. She has just finished giving evidence to what she has found so far in camera to the coroner. The pendant's centre changed to black. The evidence is under lock and key of closed court rules, the pendant announced. Its centre reverted to red. Coroner Silvana glanced at her wristwatch and grinned. Good, we'll get to see the best positions at the greening. Have you watched it before? It's beautiful, wonderfully hypnotic, Coroner Silvana grinned serenely, looking into the distance. I'm one of the lucky 1 in 100 who can get a kick out of it. Really? Don't you have to be at least a fervent of the congregation for that to happen? Absolutely not. One of those rumours a priesthood never publicly denied, she stood. It's best we leave it separately so that nobody can connect us together, at least for now. What about Priest Kylone? He'll keep quiet, believe me. Alva knew Coroner Silvana would not say anything more about how she had come across him, or why she could trust him. She felt the barrier of frustration, letting the awkward but polite silence speak for her. The aerial gallery is through the door immediately to the right and along a narrow tunnel, the coroner said. Shall I go first? Why not? The coroner slipped out. She followed 5 minutes later. Alva arrived at the ellipsoid capsule big enough to hold 20 people. Completely made out of the transparent silicara, it was barely detectable by its sheens. The only concession to substantiality was a waist-high green guardrail around the capsule's girth. Taking hold of the rail and avoiding looking down into the abyss, she lowered one foot to make contact with the clear fall, and then placed the other foot onto the invisible solidality. She forced herself to focus on the centre of the back wall, where the capsule adhered to the cliff of its silver nodules protruding through white ice. As her gaze turned towards the side of the capsule, the mottling dwindled to pure white, then faded through translucency to transparency, letting in dim blue light. Uranus's crescent, with its horns sunk behind the cliff opposite, sat like an arch over the door into the night. The vertical grey line of the planet's ring system was seen edge on, was like a crack of an opening door that extended upwards into the starfield. The sun's yellow disk sat to one side of the rings, close to the thinning crescent. She finally dared to lower her eyes onto the cliff. Its top to bottom facets gleamed dimly in shades of grey blue to silver, darkening into the shadows further down. The valley floor, 20 kilometres underneath her feet, was speckled with small craters. Although she could not make them out at this distance, Alva knew the fervents were gathering on the valley floor, waiting for the greening ceremony. Priest Kylone guided a mobile chair carrying a white-haired lady hunched up in blankets to the best observing position. A grey-haired couple followed, thanked him, and saw to the comfort of the lady. She turned, trying to hold out a wavering hand. Priest Kylone engulfed it in his big hands, giving it a gentle squeeze. Her face was old, but her eyes sparkled like those of a little girl hoping for a great treat. Beyond them, a promontory jutted into the valley. 50 meters below, its top was an alcove, lined with a carpet of small crystals. How it had been gouged out of the rock was yet another Mirandan mystery the scientists had not been able to solve. A man in black spacesuit, wearing a flowing green robe and holding a priest's rod, walked from the black back of the alcove along the man-made pathway to the promontory's edge. He stood for a few minutes, letting the robe settle on his back and drop towards the ground behind him. The planet's blue light reflected from the cliff walls opposite, waned, then changed at the cliff's top to a silver-tinged green. The greening crept down the cliff. The green strengthened at the top. The priest at the alcove's edge flicked his rod to spray holy water into the valley. Its sparkles floated down in groups of blue, yellow and green light. They would take 12 minutes to reach the valley floor, where the fervents would try and catch a droplet or two on their suits. The green on the cliff top intensified further. A blaze of emerald light from one of the cliff facets dazzled Olva. She tried to look away. Light surrounds her with a brilliance. She closes her eyes. It is still as bright. She snatches her hands to cover her eyes. She sees the grey shadows of her bones in the field of emerald. The light disappears suddenly. The sight of her bones does not. They darken into solid foam. A network of arteries and veins weave around them, into and out of her muscles. She yanks her hands away. The cliff has changed in shape into three, maybe four cliffscapes overlaid one on another. There's no telling where one cliffscape separates from the other. The only guidance was that one is green, another yellow, a third blue, and a further one silver. It is all too confusing. She concentrates on a single line running down the fading emerald cliff face. The facet cuts back from this line into the cliff to separate the emerald block from the silver one. There is a second facet cutting back into the cliff from the same line, separating the emerald from the royal blue one. The blocks are distinct, occupying different spaces. Yet there is not enough room in front of her for all these blocks. She struggles to make sense of this view. Up to now, she has only seen things like this no more than 2 meters in diameter. This is thousands of times larger. It makes her feel small, dizzy, and scared. Alva grabs the green guardrail. Her hand goes right through it. Her balance falters. She manages to steady herself. Light lines of all colours reach and touch and go through her. She is at one with a different, indecipherable world. She is happy. The lines of light curl. The dizziness returns. Alva felt her head lying on something soft, and the rest of her body was on a hard surface. She opened her eyes. Priest Kylone was bending over her, holding her hand in it as his green eyes studied her carefully. "I'm glad you're back with us." She tried to smile, but didn't know whether she'd succeeded, so turned her head towards the cliff. Its facets were now coloured in shades of yellow and silver, reflecting pure sunlight. The greening was over. Coroner Sylvana stepped into a partially block of view and dropped a blanket over her. "What happened?" Alva asked. "You blacked out. Although it's not unusual, it's been known to happen. Something to do with the light flicker, or so the people who have been affected say," Coroner Sylvana said, smiling. "Sorry, I spoilt the greening for you," Alva said. "But you did not. I was too far entranced by it to notice Priest Cologne catch you." She turned to Priest Cologne. He nodded. "You lie there and relax a little bit. Then I'll make sure I'll get you back home safely." Alva tried but couldn't. Her hand going through the guardrail scared her. It had to be a trick of the lights. Yet the feeling that it had really happened continued to nag her. Now, some of you already know about Cat. He's appeared in 3 novelettes, courtesy of TWB Press, and you can get it wherever, but it's only in e-format. I am in the middle of writing his fourth adventure, and I thought I'd give you a little bit of a hint of a start on that. The story at the moment is called Space Blind. Cat stared down at the muscular body on the morgue slab and engaged its facial recognition app. Cropped white hair, red beard, square jaw, aquiline nose, pale brown eyes, arched eyebrows. No match. He pulled on the central computer's people ident libraries of all of Neptune's planetary system, not just Triton base. No match. He pulled on the whole of the solar system's medical records and visa offices databases. Still no match. The dead man was a nobody. So how did he die? Commander Zachman entered with Nikita, his new guard robocap, prancing in front, checking every nook for hidden dangers. Her tail was straight up in the air, and so alluring as ever, Kat could not take one of his video sensors off her. Damn that I Want a Treat app. He wanted to delete it, but his emotion app was luxuriating in the enjoyment like an addict. And he still had to pretend to be a lovesick robocat to give Zachman an excuse to keep Nikita close by. With Zachman now being a prime target for the bandits, he needed all the protection he could get. His blood pressure suffered a sudden and catastrophic drop. The doc came in and took his position on the opposite side of the body to Zachman. That rules out space blindness. The doc raised a questioning eyebrow. The pilot who picked him up suggested it. The slightest of tremors ran down Zachman's body. Cat pulled on his memory banks for the fact. Zachman had lost 3 good pilots to the spaceman's new curse in the last 6 months. Classic symptoms were fixating on an object to the exclusion of everything else, following it wherever, trying to keep it in sight. They called it awesome, glorious, wonderful. Nothing could break out from that fixation. Inevitably, they flew into an accident that caused their deaths. It was something more unusual, Doc said. He died of fright. He was spooked? Zachman paused, frowning. I suppose finding yourself in the middle of space with nowhere to get to an airlock could have done that. Why didn't he call for help on his comms? His space suit was in perfect working order. It recorded his time of death as the 5th of April at 7:30 in the morning. That's 3 weeks ago. Wouldn't his body deteriorated? Spacesuit switched the oxygen supply off and kept the moisture levels ambient, hence no decay. Cat accessed the records of the stranger's retrieval from a central computer. A routine patrol had detected an object where the gravitational arrangement meant there should not have been one. In Neptune's outermost ring, between its 11th and 12th spokes of amassed ice and dust. So the pilot had diverted to take a look. She found the dead man with his arms and legs splayed out, floating from the planet. Cat's logic module flipped away. Neptune's gravity should have been pulling the dead man towards it. He checked the dead man's spacesuit thrusters. The fuel levels were full. The man had been pushed. A victim of foul play. I'll leave it at that. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Rosie. We normally do a Q&A session at the end of the readings, but as you have to rush off, I should probably give you your little interrogation before you go. One thing that struck me from the stories is that you seem to be rather fond of Neptune. Is there any particular reason for that?
It just happens to be one of the less explored spaces of the solar system, and therefore it's actually got an awful lot of curious things if you actually start looking for them. And once you start looking, you find more and more, and it sort of becomes a bit addictive, if I may say so.
Well, you're the first person I've ever met who's been addicted to a planet. Especially such a remote planet as well. The other thing I noticed from the novel, a lot of science fiction writers tend to assume that in the future we will, of course, have outgrown religion, but you had priests in your story. So presumably you think that religion will always be with us.
In one form, yes or no, what I have done is I've changed the religion to be one of the science-based religion, because they're trying to survive on this harsh moon, and they need all the help they can get, so they're looking for reasons why odd things are happening on this particular moon, and that's how the priesthood eventually sort of grew out of the mining community.
Hey, anybody in the audience have any questions for Rosie? Justin?
Could you tell us a little bit about your inspiration? How did you come to write science fiction? Where did you start? What were your favourite books to start with?
I don't think you're going to believe this answer. I actually read an awful lot of science fiction ever since childhood, and I just adored reading it. But what started me writing science fiction was actually when me and my late husband were driving in Wales, and there were these poor sheep limping along, and I was feeling sorry for them. And then my husband turned around and said, "They're suffering from sheep foot rot." And at that point I decided, you know, not all was what it seemed, and from there on in it just sort of a concatenation of events led me to write a short description of Dogger Bank Island out in the North Sea, which then led on to my first rather scrappy novel of the fishing industry in the North Sea, which I'm a little bit ashamed of, and things just went from there.
Some of the description, I think in the first story you read, reminded me of some of Ian Banks' description of the vast waterfall in one of his stories. I think it was Matter, I'm not sure which. But have you read Ian Banks, or what are your particular, your favourite sci-fi authors?
I've obviously read a lot of the old authors like Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov, Anne McCaffrey, and you name it. I've read very little Ian Banks, although I do have the books to read. I've read a lot of Alistair Reynolds. Currently sitting on my reading is the Madeleine Ashby's VN series, so that's where I'm going with that. So, unfortunately, I don't know anything about this waterfall scene.
Any other questions for Rosie? In which case, I declare it replenishing your drinks time, and we'll reconvene in a few minutes time. Let's start here. Thank you very much, Rosie.
Bristol Con Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the Bristol Con Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.